Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. We are in dead air, the interregnum between the old year, signified by Christmas, and the new year orgy that starts in less than 100 hours. I start today's program with my old friend, Michael Horowitz, who wrote an article for the North Coast Times-Eagle at the Millennium, and he called it Recurrence of Cultural Enthusiasm, with a couple of quotes, the first from the I Ching, hexagram 16. The enthusiasm of the heart expresses itself involuntarily in a burst of song, in dance and rhythmic movement of the body. From immemorial times, the inspiring effect of the invisible sound that moves all hearts and draws them together has mystified mankind. And Antonin Artaud, we need to live first of all, to believe in what makes us live, and that something makes us live. Astrologers tell us that every two millennia, due to the wandering of vernal equinox, we move from the influence of one constellation to another. The Greco-Roman empires, we learn, were the fated projects of the Age of Aries, the Christian epic, the inevitable child of the charitable age of Pisces, and our future synthesis of religion and science will herald the age of Aquarius. The notion of an era is not limited to astrologers, however. Historians of the West will readily speak of the Classical Age, the Middle Ages, the modern period, and just now, the postmodern possibility. The Classical Age is imagined to be a period of secular initiation when institutions such as the academy, the sciences, the theater, the law, and the empire were begun. The medieval alternative is described as being more integrated, with society organized in hierarchy and Catholic rationale reigning the huddle. Commerce marks the modern period, we're told, when individualized action shapes Protestantism and capitalism. As for the postmodern period, we have only guesses, but it has been suggested that it had something to do with Eastern philosophy in the West. All this raises a question that should be answered briefly before proceeding. What leads human beings to act for hundreds of years in a way that can consistently be called an age? The answer, I think, is twofold. First, there is a desire in complex societies to attach behavior to a set of ideas that is traditional. Second, there is a desire in complex societies to attach behavior to a set of ideas that is vital. This, of course, is what creates social tension, or for what is traditional is not necessarily vital. An age is simply the arena in which the battle is fought. More precisely, a particular attempt to balance particular traditions with particular vitalities. For example, the Middle Ages can be seen as the trial of Catholic rationale. Can it provide a viable transition from classical hedonism? Can it accommodate nascent nationalism? Aquinas asserts that it can. Eventually, however, the vitalities of science, Reformation, and capital overwhelm the Catholic tradition. But is this all that happens as we move from one age to another? Cultural effervescence. The underlying assumption in standard historical analysis is that changes of age are ideological, that the alterations appear because of a chance press of new ideas. Furthermore, there is usually a value assumption of progress. Pastoral society yields to Christian diligence, yields to industrial mastery. I do not intend here to question the value of progress. I am impressed enough with the fragileness of our planet's orbit to know that we must eventually command the technology to move ourselves from it. But humanity cannot live on progress alone, and it is ridiculous to construct our history on that sole pillar. Were progress to be our only concern, we would all be busy like bees and ants building computers and reactors. Granted, some lack the intelligence to do this, even if they wanted to, but others deliberately choose not to be engineers. There is another historical dimension besides progress, namely the effervescence of culture. It is absolutely necessary that we have fresh ways to dress, play music, make love, play sports, dance, worship, and govern. Seen from this angle, the process of changing epochs takes on an additional meaning. To use the example of the church again, it begins as an ethical aggregate of people living amidst what is considered a rich, corrupt, secular empire. Paul's enthusiasm is obvious. In splendor without spot or wrinkle, holy and without blemish. The ensuing centuries are attempts at refinement, Augustine and the dialectic of conversion, Aquinas and the accommodation with reason. Eventually, however, the church is discredited because it is thought to be dogmatic and corrupt. Historians view these facts with varying bias. The progressive views the Middle Ages as a reactionary calamity. The West is said to have fled freedom of thought for the shibboleths of medieval Catholicism. Others, currently in vogue, display the Middle Ages as a magic delight, haplessly exposed to the harsh lineation of Protestant capitalism. History as a brothel. But let us desert the preoccupation with ideas and concern ourselves with enthusiasm, that is, to exchange the concept of rationale for morale. I see the facts like this, that St. Paul and the disciples trembled with the excitement of renewal, while Roman senators stumbled nauseously into vomitoriums. Yet, by the 16th century, the excitement is not in the church. It is in the rejection of clerical art and music. They cheered as Michelangelo's statue of David was pulled through the streets of Florence. What is clear is that cultural enthusiasm is history's genuine prostitute, sashaying from bed to bed without regard for ideology. Historians loathe to recognize her for fear of converting history into a brothel. But history is the study of human social nature in process. On then to consider it with or without the historians. The proposal is to turn the notion of cultural enthusiasm into an historical artifact. Cultural enthusiasm may be defined as an escalation of social energy catalyzing an historical revitalization of culture. I submit that it is a social aspect of complex culture to periodically explode its overriding rationale, and that this serves a natural purpose akin to the crucial social acts of reproduction, manufacture, and worship. This has the ring of biology to it. I can't help that. History inevitably meets biology if it concerns itself with life. The fear of enthusiasm among historians is not without foundation. How is one to distinguish between constructive and destructive enthusiasm? Wasn't Nazism an enthusiastic event? Didn't Ezra Pound enthusiastically announce Mussolini's new order? I assert two responses to their concerns. First, the change of age that fascism boasted never took place in historical retrospect. Fascism was only a challenge to liberal capitalism and was defeated. The only bona fide changes of age in recent Western history have been the rise of Greece, the fall of Rome, and the Protestant Reformation. Secondly, an age is a large room. It cannot constrain people too tightly. Part of the inefficiency of Nazism was its tin can quality. It wasn't big enough to accommodate an age. I'm not saying an age has to be noble, but there was a grandeur to the Roman Empire, to the Catholic Church, to international capitalism that could at least entertain the aspirations of many peoples. I give away my motive for when I say there was a grandeur to international capitalism. For certainly the reason to write this essay is the premonition that the modern period is coming to a close, that the bourgeois edifice of liberal capitalism is beginning to depress more significant people than it impresses. Traditional notions of individualism, incessant work, and material progress are beginning to wear thin, and the resulting fatigue has caused some to speak of the omnipresence of the grotesque. An age beckons. What are we coming to? No one has more than inklings of where we're going. We hear the electronic music with primitive rhythms. We experience tribal ecstasy with artificial chemicals. We trim our hair long with electric shavers. It appears that, as our astrologers say, we aim to have our technology and our mystery, too. the age of Aquarius beckons. From a certain point of view, a coldly rational one, it seems hardly worth it to desert progressive Protestantism. After all, Protestantism has given us a lot. It has cured many diseases. It has freed the individual mind and given us awesome technological power and comfort. What does the New Age offer us? What does the New Age offer us? At worst, slavery in the name of tribalism, poverty in the name of ecology. But, qu'en est-il? For what is operative now is not ideological, but cultural restlessness. It seems to permeate societies whose rationales are unable to energize. It particularly affects the young, supporting my suspicion that cultural rejuvenation is linked to generative concerns. This is not to suggest we are ending the modern period and commencing the postmodern. It is to say the opportunity is there. My only purpose is to speculate on what we are flirting with, the change of an age. Such changes ultimately occur impulsively. Complex societies simply seem to desire them. It is as irrational as panic. For what purpose? And yet, as Artaud knew, panic has a purpose. If we must dance the Saint Vitus, we should understand why. Don't let ex post facto judges fool you. The changing of an age is not entirely due to the inevitability of a righteous challenge. It additionally involves a shrouded social recurrence whose origins, I'm sure, will become clearer once we more earnestly study them. Until that time, we must at least recognize that the birth of a new rationale enables an ever-changing definition of progress to inspire the vigorous continuation of history. And that was Recurrence of Cultural Enthusiasm by Michael Horowitz, and a poem that he wrote for a book he wrote, Process. I believe that the universe is processing itself. I believe that space, time, and matter energy are manifestations of process processing itself. I believe there is a threshold where space, time, and matter energy become process. I believe that process is beyond time, beyond space, beyond matter, and beyond energy. It is eternal, boundless, formless, and forceless. Process, processes. I believe that the next moment is random, but the last moment could not have happened any other way. I believe that life is an imperfect relation with process. The effects of process are that life is balanced by death, love is balanced by hate, good is balanced by evil, and light is balanced by darkness. I believe that love is living encouragement to live, grow, love, and reproduce. I believe that it is the nature of life to live, grow, love, reproduce, and draw closer to process. There is no meaning to life, only a process of living. I believe that the process of living is living according to one's nature, while being conscious that one's nature is in imperfect relation with process. Yet one's nature is changing, and human nature is changing. I struggle against process. I cooperate with process. I trust process to process. And that was by Michael Horowitz. And it's from his novel, Equator. And Michael is author of a Freaks anthology, Golden Hits from Buddha to Kubrick, and as a nom de Bloom, as you might call it, as V. Bloom, the book Equator, Sunbelt Stories, Split Creek, and his final book so far, Down Mind, a psycho-experimental novella. He is president of the world's smallest university in the Pacific island of Tonga. And now, something I wrote, which I call A Short History of the Millennium. Very few of humanity's billions will ever be remembered for very long or be recorded for more than village histories, and the names who momentarily preoccupy our era will as surely vanish. Of our rapidly fluid epoch, which encompasses parts of two millennia, perhaps only Hitler and Gandhi might remain long in the future as icons of our dark and light. And Einstein, who asked two compelling questions that altered our cosmology. Where am I? How am I moving? All the rest is E equals MC squared. Only recently have women's claims to history been taken seriously, and in Western society, it is difficult to entertain any other than a Caucasian cosmogony. The epic human struggle is usually portrayed as East against West, of yellow peril against white is right, of crescent against cross, and both against Judaism. Black and white are absolutely considered incompatible. The only real significance of the eternal conflicts is the epic flow of blood, the slaughter at each turn of history's pages for reasons as brief as their lives. The names of the multitudes are lost. Only the numbers are marked, aggregates of immense folly and depravity. Man is born, suffers, and dies, is the legendary crystallization of Egypt's long ancient history, and might elliptically be the essential history of humanity. The German Count Gottlieb von Hassler enlarged the thought toward the end of the 19th century when he said, unconsciously anticipating the world wars of the 20th century, "It is necessary that our civilization build its temple on a mountain of corpses, on an ocean of tears, and on the death cries of men without number." A major significant fact about this transmillennial epoch is its mountains of corpses, laid out as civilization's temple, as the purpose or outcome of its greatest scientific and technological creations. At the very heart of the temple are the death camps of World War II, which names will very likely reverberate with a shudder up through the centuries: Auschwitz, Treblinka, Dachau. Simultaneously, the purpose of splitting the atom to obliterate large numbers of the human species might cause future humanity, however bountiful nuclear energy, to regard its second millennium progenitors as at least as barbaric as we regard our cave-dwelling forebears. A paradox that underlies history is that the eras of greatest creativity and discovery are also the most dangerous. The 7 decades since World War II are unparalleled in advances of knowledge and productivity, comparable to the entirety of the previous 10 millennia, and human culture has consequently structured technologies that are disintegrating civilization, even as contemporary civilized life owes its existence to them. Science is most obviously the Pied Piper this era dances to. Science and its handmaiden technology modernize civilization by routinely ripping away its fabric without making much effort to repair it in a kaleidoscopic surge into an incomprehensible future. This is the point at which history is declared dead, without significant meaning or impact, except as memory and latent nostalgia, because it is claimed to no longer have any bearing or effect on present or future. The race is to the swift who disregard consequences. The present is patently obsolete as it careens into the future. Although human progress is typically measured through technical prowess and achievement, it should at least be as important to concentrate on the contradictory evolution of human rights and freedoms and the painfully slow development toward a world civilization free of despotism and tyranny. Like it or not, humanity is a global species, crowding into every accommodable space on the planet. Humanity eternally pushes at the edge of evolution, impatiently and recklessly remaking the natural world into its own image, meanwhile overthrowing nature as well. Perhaps the major consistency in our history is our disdain for our only natural enemy, nature. The natural world in which we have spent the great majority of our history, though our history is mostly unrecorded, is regarded as an adversary to be overcome and altered to our design, whether domesticating grains and animals to cloning them and ourselves. The reality of attaining an equitable world civilization will obviously be much more rough and tumble than is generally the vision, given the dyspepsia of our ill-tempered species. Yet the rising tectonic turbulence by impoverished, overcrowded, and cruelly governed masses of humanity is a basic struggle for a decent life on this planet. this most ancient desire to be a part of a community, not enslaved by it, might very well readjust the center of power and pioneer the first truly universal human community in its long evolution. Universal amalgamation might provide the basis for human diaspora beyond a home planet that is rapidly changing into a hostile world. The fact that we have already started the process of making Earth unlivable for our species and others, there is yet a near future of many more generations who will be forced to live on a dying world bequeathed by callously reckless predecessors. By abandoning our heirs so that the present dwellers of Mother Earth can live in comfort might be a just rationale for nuclear extinction. More placid possibilities than self-ruin are that we reconfigure our DNA with electrical impulsation into the human neural system, a robotization that has been hailed as humanity's next great evolution, the bionic transformation out of biology. A way might be found to keep the world's masses of poor people alive and healthy in exchange for body parts and internal organs for rich folk. Herds of healthy poor can be kept available for harvest in a future dystopian collapse. Male humans might become extinct as a result of biological and reproductive irrelevancy. The cold reality is that women can survive as the lone gender and continue to perpetuate the species, female, as well as the busy work necessary for survival of anthropological disaster. Nuclear weapons rendered the nation-state dead as dinosaurs, despite recurrent regressive xenophobic rise of nationalist sentiment, such as the atavistic Make America Great Again, convulsing United States politics. A world civilization encompasses billions of human beings, leaving out a trillion other living organisms, several of which humanity has more rapidly made extinct or endangered the past 100 years than at any other time. But everything has accelerated as well as the human birth rate and population sprawl that seems to have no end in sight. More babies are born every day than dead left to make room for them, and that despite daily baby mortality worldwide from hunger, poor medicine, and incessant warfare, humanity overflows Earth like maggots on a peach. The human fabric is interwoven from billions of diverse threads that dissolve into everybody moving around at random with no apparent distinguishable themes as they bump into each other, just billions of ordinary persons doing individually what they wish or feel obliged to do without patterns large enough to frame, swarming like protozoa in a drop of water. The sum total of human works does not equal in all parts put together the achievements of the life forms of plant and insect in a square foot of grass, the writer Philip Wiley said in 1968, which in a few days will have been half a century ago. The true millennium this era ordains really started in the middle of the 20th century when humanity cracked the atom. It was also a moment when human beings realized this cosmic power they unleashed from its locks might be the doom of humanity. It was one of those rare moments that seemed as if everything before that moment was inexorably directed toward it and afterward will be measured from it. Quite like it will be with us on the Pacific Northwest coast when the Cascadia earthquake and tsunami rupture our lives sooner than later. Humanity's sly calculation of time might not fit any other world than its own, and even so is a compromise between observation and superstition. This beginning of an early year of the third millennium of a parochial calendar might be an opportunity to reassess a few perceptions of human reign over our very small, fragile, crowded planet. It really makes little sense to fear the future. After all, it is where we will spend the rest of our lives. Every moment is new, like waves from an immense ocean, each second an uncertainty, unexplored and doubtful, and as instantly history, irretrievable, except in memory and myth. Arthur Rimbaud wrote, "At dawn, armed with burning patience, we shall enter the splendid cities." And Samuel Beckett, "You must go on. I can't go on. I'll go on." And I close this program with Albert Pinkham Ryder, who I think among the best American artists, though runners up to that claim pant down his palate. He was born in 1847 and died 100 years ago in 1918. He anticipated several paths of 20th century art, which continues into this millennium. Yet he was half blind, which made focusing on small details or looking at bright light painful. Moonlight and the ocean, thickly layered with paint, were his major subjects. And though he was never regarded as a realist, which set him apart from contemporaries whose lush fantasies of fluff were regarded at the time as reality, his dark visions repelled his more fashionable fellow artists. Ryder's paintings were a visual glimpse of both Edgar Allan Poe and John Milton, assimilated in yellowish gray, brown, indigo, and black. His most noted and provocative painting is of a pale gray human skeleton carrying death's scythe, barebone, on a lean spectral horse galloping around a racetrack of sorts, which he finished in 1910. Again, a ghostly yellow, gray, brown, also green, which one critic said was a light not of this world. My favorite painting by Ryder, which I consider the best American painting, is perhaps also its simplest in form and color, painted in the 1880s. Two black daubs sitting in the stern of a black single-masted sailing boat, its black sail sharp as a knife blade, wallowing in a nearly black ocean underneath a large black cloud, shaped like a thumbprint in an ashen gray sky. He called it Under a Cloud. Almost in a single stroke, he etched my own ambivalent reaction to clinging aboard frail fishing vessels in a vast, uncertain ocean, which I knew even so was a metaphor for my precarious and barely cognitive hold on life. But he also projected the upcoming 20th century under this dark cloud, awash on his sinister black ocean, though his own sense seems an inchoate spirituality that might be a template for humanity's angst about converging into this latest millennium of its own counting. It is an almost childlike painting, except for the knowing, tremulous chill it evokes at sight of it. This is Michael McCusker. Happy New Year.